An official started to yell, "Hey, you can't just pick people up here!" But Jack barged past him and leapt onto the boat. Just then the gun went off, marking the start of the race. The three of us quickly pushed off, set the sails, and headed out to the starting line. Jack made a quick change below deck into clothes more appropriate for sailing, and I handed the tiller to my brother. We were late, but we were on our way. It was a long course and a drizzly, misty day, and we had trouble seeing the other boats. But even with our late start, we managed a first in our division. Jack had taken a different route from all the other boats, and there had been a wind shift that we were able to take advantage of before any of the other racers. What a thrill! There was a lot of cheer aboard Victura that afternoon. On the way into Edgartown Harbor, Jack got drenched by a passing motorboat, but he quickly dried himself off and changed back into his blue suit. Pretty soon, we saw his little single-engine plane flying over us again, en route back to Washington. He disappeared into the mist. I said farewell to Milton in May 1950, and launched out with Joey Gargan on a summer trip through Europe. My letters home show that I complained of paying an outrageous bill and getting caught stealing ashtrays in Sorrento, eating cornflakes in Florence, upsetting a canoe on Lake Como, visiting Hitler's eagle's nest at Berchtesgaden, and contemplating the Nazi death camp at Dachau. Harvard awaited me in the fall. I felt ready for it. Chapter 5. The Harvard Screw-Up, 1950-1958. The Harvard I entered in the fall of 1950 was in many ways the timeless Harvard of my father's and brother's eras, a grand old national treasure of tree-scattered greens and yards and ancient red-brick buildings. Legendary professors such as Samuel Eliot Morrison and John Kenneth Galbraith hurried to classrooms filled with intense young gentlemen scholars in their Harris tweed jackets, their pipes tucked into their breast pockets. There were the final clubs and parties. Harvard was familiar to me from my many autumnal visits with the family to watch Jack and Bobby play football. I'd even visited Joe Jr. there once when he was in law school and was amazed by how messy his room was. I savored an unfamiliar feeling, adultness, as I unpacked my suitcases in room C-31 of the low-slung Wigglesworth dormitories that stretch along the southern edge of Harvard Yard. But I was still a kid in many ways, still the kid in the family. I look forward to a rosy, uncomplicated existence as a Harvard man, good fellowship with new friends, stimulating contact with great professors, and playing football. As it turned out, my existence at Harvard was much more complicated than I had hoped. I started off lucky with a great roommate, a slim, sandy-haired boy named Dudley Richards. I'd casually known Dudley from summers in Hyannisport. He and his brother Ross were good sailors. Ross had sailed against Bobby and given him all my brother could handle. Dudley's passion was ice skating, and by his early teens he was a top Olympic prospect. But at 16 he'd seemingly shattered that dream. Diving into water that was shallower than he realized, he'd suffered a broken neck. He recovered, but only after 2 years of intensive physical therapy, during which time he did not skate at all. By the end of freshman year, Dudley's hard work had paid off and he'd gained the rank of number 2 amateur skater in the nation. Our friendship continued after Harvard, and I cheered him from afar as he went on to win some Olympic bronze and silver medals. In January 1961, Dudley shared a gold medal in the pairs at the U.S. Championships with the young skating star he intended to marry, Maribel Owen. Tragically, they both were killed, along with the entire U.S. skating team, in a plane crash on the way to the World Figure Skating Championships in Prague in February 1961. I drove to Cambridge in my mother's old blue coupe in that fall of 1950. As soon as I was able to buy a snazzy Pontiac of my own, I got a special horn for it, a horn that sounded like a cow's anxious moo. I considered that fairly stylish and amusing, but as always seemed to happen, word of the horn made its way back to my father, and I received the following letter from him. I heard in my roundabout way that you are using that bell of yours on that car. I don't want to be complaining about things you do, but I want to point out to you that when you exercise any privilege that the ordinary fellow does not avail himself of, you immediately become the target for display and newspaper criticism. It's all right to struggle to get ahead of the masses by good works, by good reputation, and by hard work, but it certainly isn't by doing things that could lead people to say, "Who the hell does he think he is?" I got rid of the cowhorn. Pulling a Harvard jersey over my head and shoulder pads to play freshman football was one of the thrills of my young life. At 6'2" and 210 pounds, I had the right size for a college player in those days. Making cleat marks and crashing into other solid bodies on the same field where my brothers had played, it didn't seem that life could hold anything better than that. Dad made all my home games, where he helped out the coach by pacing the sidelines, wearing a beret, and shouting instructions. One dear figure's passing tempered my joy that fall. John Fitzgerald, my grandfather, succumbed to a long illness on October 2nd. He had been delighted in Jack's congressional victory 4 years earlier. Grandpa's death not only marked the passing of an era, it also served as a bright line marker for the end of my childhood. In due course, I would awaken to Harvard's intellectual bounties and find in them the building blocks for my lifelong education, in particular, my grasp of national and international political thought. My fall semester, in fact, was respectable, if not stellar, in my coursework. But in the spring of 1951, my mind turned, or returned, to thoughts of football and to staying in condition so that I could go for the varsity squad in the fall. There were other reasons for my gridiron passion. Most of the friendships I'd made at Harvard were through football. John Culver, Claude Hooton, Dick Clasby, and I loved being part of a team. I didn't want to lose that. In most other ways that first year, I don't remember Harvard as being a particularly hospitable place. Not for me, at any rate. So I threw myself into the spring football drills to the extent that my grade suffered, my Spanish grade especially. I worried that if I flunked or made a D on the final exam, I wouldn't be eligible to play football in the fall. I expressed my concerns to a friend in the dorm, Warren O'Donnell. He jokingly suggested that I let another buddy, Bill Freight, take the exam for me. I laughed off the idea, but then Warren brought it up again, in Bill's presence. Bill laughed and said he might get a worse grade than me. But then, trying to be a friend in need, he checked the exam schedule and saw that he was free at the time of the Spanish test. I'd already dropped the idea, but when I ran into him at dinner that night, Bill told me that if I wanted him to do it, he was willing. To my lasting regret, I said, "Great." I didn't think it through. I made an immature, spontaneous, extremely poor and wrong decision. Bill took the exam under the eye of a proctor who happened to be his advisor and who knew he'd already passed a Spanish test, which had exempted him from having to take the course. Harvard sentenced each of us to a year's suspension. We were told we could come back if we'd done something useful with that time. I felt terrible. I knew I'd screwed up. I felt even worse about having to face my father. I called up Jack and told him what had happened. Jack agreed to give Dad a heads up while I drove to the Cape to see him. It was the longest and worst drive I ever had to make. I recall thinking as I drove that there were so many ifs involved. If I'd not confided my worries about Spanish to Warren, if he hadn't suggested to Bill Freight that he might take my place, if Bill had not been free, if there had been another proctor. But in the final analysis, the ifs didn't matter. I knew I was to blame because I had embraced the idea. My father met me in the sunroom. He alternated between disappointment and anger for quite a while. "Why didn't you get ahead of this?" he asked me. "Why didn't you act responsibly? See what happens when you do these things?" The more we talked, the quieter his voice would get. But then the phone would ring, one of my brothers expressing concern, offering advice. And when I came back into the room, he'd tee off on me again. "There are people who can mess up in life and not get caught," he advised me at one point, "but you're not one of them, Teddy." Boy, was he ever right. By the next day, he'd settled down and begun to think about what my options were. We thought about other schools, but I wanted to prove myself and return to Harvard. Serving in the military made the most sense. I signed up for the Army at the old building that still stands along the docks in Boston. My father thought the military would do me good. He was tough, and he was deeply disappointed in me, but he never gave up on me. He wanted me to learn from this experience. Another thing I recall about Dad during this crisis was that he was concerned on behalf of Bill Freight. He recognized that Bill had been trying to help me and wanted to be supportive of him. Bill, to his great credit, took responsibility for his own actions and said he wanted to stand on his own. He went to another school for a year, then came back and graduated from Harvard. Vicky and I still see Bill Freight and his wife, Anne. Once a year, we find a weekend to get together with some of my old football buddies and their wives for a Harvard game. Often it's the Harvard-Yale game, and the company includes Bill and Anne, John Culver, destined to be a lifelong friend of mine and an outstanding Democrat. He represented Iowa both as a senator and a congressman, along with his wife, Mary Jane, as well as Dick Clasby, who was one of the greatest ever to play at Harvard. He was a three-sport man, football team captain, and in 1952 broke loose for a 96-yard touchdown run from scrimmage in the game against Washington University of St. Louis. Dick married Joe Gargan's sister and my very dear friend and cousin Mary Joe. We're joined by my dear friend, Paul Kirk, who played for the Crimson a few years later, and his wife, Gail, and Bill Cleary, the All-American hockey player for Harvard and Olympic gold medalist, and his wife, Joe. Until his death, my classmate Jeff Coolidge was also part of our annual gathering. And Claude Hooten has joined us. We have a big dinner at an Italian family-style restaurant. Then the next day we go to the stadium and have a great tailgate party. Then we see the game. But of course, all this was years into the future. At the time, I wondered whether I'd ever get back to Harvard in any capacity. I did my basic training at Fort Dix, New Jersey. I was in the 39th Infantry of the 9th Infantry Division. I worked hard through 16 weeks of summertime heat and didn't sleep much. KP duty saw to that. I received thorough training in washing dishes and emptying garbage cans. I also found myself in combat, hard fighting against my will and with my fists, and not with the enemy. Up until then, I'd had very little contact with African Americans. I was now at close quarters with several in our platoon, including another enlisted man named Wharton. One day, Wharton and I, along with a fellow named Fezzia, got gigged for having dirty rifles. Our penalty was to take some brooms, go over, and clean out the officers' quarters. I wanted to get it done early because Harvard was playing football and it was being televised and I wanted to see it. When I realized that Wharton was missing from our three-man detail, I suggested to Fezzia that he go and find him. Fezzia went to Wharton's barracks and returned with the news that Wharton says he may come or he may not. I snapped, "That's ridiculous." Fezzia suggested, a little too casually in retrospect, that perhaps I should go over and reason with him. I did. On the second floor of the barracks, I found probably 8 men rolling dice against a footlocker. I said, "Is Wharton around here?" This fellow stood up. He was African-American, about 6'4" and 185 pounds of muscle, and said, "I'm Wharton." I said, "Wharton, you got gigged." "Yeah, I got gigged." I said, "You've got to come over and clean out the BOQ like the rest of us." He said, "Well, maybe I'm coming, and maybe I'm not." I said, "You're coming." He said, "You telling me something?" Then the reasoning began. We launched into a really bad fight. It was the wrestling I'd learned from Louis Andrews at Milton and my football conditioning that saved me. As it was, I had my hands full with Wharton. Had the fight been outdoors on an open field, the techniques I'd learned in wrestling would have made it nearly impossible for him to stay with me. If you can take an opponent down, roll him, get a leg lock on him, you've pretty well got him. But in a barracks, you're rolling and you roll into a foot locker and suddenly he's on top of you. And Wharton got on top of me, pounding away and grabbing at my face. I thought he was going to put my eyes out. I put up a hand and he bit right through it. He bit harder than the zebra. I think I got the better of him in the end. Wrestling is defensive and I finally managed to immobilize him, which was good enough for me. There was blood all over the barracks, some of it Wharton's, much of it mine. A sergeant named McGuire came storming into the room, blew his whistle, and ordered us both to get back over to the BOQ and finish cleaning it. "And you fellows can continue your fight at 6 o'clock on the parade ground." Continue the fight at 6 o'clock on the parade ground? I couldn't believe it. That's the last thing in the world I wanted to do. But if I had to, I had to. So at 6 o'clock, I was pacing around the flagpole on the parade ground. And at 6:05, I was out of there. Wharton hadn't showed up. Lucky for me. I heard that in his next fight, he knocked out every tooth in the other guy's head. With about 2 weeks still to go in basic training, I started formulating another idea. I would volunteer to go to Korea. I believed that it was my duty, a necessary phase of my atonement. I knew the risks. The war had stalemated. Peace talks had begun. But American and Chinese troops were still slaughtering one another on the misty slopes of Bloody Ridge and Heartbreak Ridge. On a 3-day pass, I met Bobby and Jack in New York. Over lunch, I told them about my idea. Both were appalled and strenuously argued against my volunteering. "Mother and Dad have suffered enough," one of them said to me. "We can't afford to have you go over and risk getting killed. You just can't do this kind of thing. Go where the Army assigns you and do your part." I thought about this. I realized that I was being selfish and was risking unspeakable grief for my parents. "God, I don't want to do that," I told myself. "I've been enough of a screw-up already." I accepted an assignment to the Counterintelligence Corps Center at Fort Holabird, Maryland. CIC agents had guarded the Manhattan Project against spies during the war, and as anti-communist fervor took hold in the 1950s, the potential for spy versus spy intrigue promised to increase. Unfortunately, my career as a spy was fleeting. After 2 months, I found myself transferred to Camp Gordon, Georgia, for training with the military police. I couldn't figure out why. Jack later learned that someone reported me in the company of one or two people at Harvard who might have had leftist leanings. Now that was a joke. I was a lot less interested in the left end of politics than the right end of the football line. I later came to suspect that I'd been blackballed by Roy Cohn, the anti-communist zealot and future counsel for Joe McCarthy. Cohn was just then enjoying national fame for his role in the convictions of accused spies Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. He was jealous of my brother Bobby's rise as a prosecutor and may have been trying to intimidate or harass him through smearing me. Whatever the case, my main achievement at Camp Gordon was to set a camp record for chin-ups with more than 40 repetitions. Then in June 1952, I was finally assigned overseas, to the 520th Military Police Service Company at Camp La Loge, near Roquencourt, in the Paris suburb of Versailles. Before shipping out, I traveled to Hyannisport to say goodbye to my parents. My mother, well-meaning to the last, asked, "Well, where are you going to be?" I told her I would be in France and Germany. She came alive with ideas for teachable moments, ideas I rather fancied. "Oh, that's marvelous, Teddy. Now, in France, they have wonderful wine, because that's where they make it. And in Germany, they have wonderful beer, because that's where they make beer. And Joe," she said, turning brightly toward my father, "I think Teddy ought to be able to drink the wine and the beer, even though he isn't 21 yet." Dad's answer revealed that he was in a somewhat less teachable mood. "Rose," he said, spinning around to examine her, "are you out of your mind?" That effectively took the wind out of the sails for my permission to drink wine and beer in Europe that year. I did, anyway. What my parents didn't know was that I'd begun drinking beer and wine at Harvard. Dad had made a deal with each of his sons. If we refrained from drinking and smoking until we were 21, we'd receive a reward of $1,000. Later, when my 21st birthday came around, I confessed to Dad that I had taken liquor but had not smoked. Dad was true to his end of the bargain. I got $500. With the Korean War raging and the armed services on full alert, my company had orders to guard the newly built Supreme Allied Headquarters, SHAPE, near Roquencourt, mostly by walking the perimeter of the compound. One night on leave, I decided to taste the delights of Paris. Since the city lay only about 20 kilometers from the base, I walked there. I don't remember much about the delights, but I do recall making my way back toward the barracks at about 3:30 in the morning. Upon reaching Roquencourt, I realized I could not identify the road to the base in the darkness. I stopped in at one of the few coffee shops still open and asked directions. The proprietor was helpful, but three men sitting at a table eyed me coldly. Somehow, I realized they were communists. French communists disliked the American military even more than ordinary French people did. I eased out of the coffee house and started down the unlit street. As I walked, I began to hear a steady choom, 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 choom behind me. I was being followed by men armed with something that went choom, 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 choom as they walked. I began to run. Now the choom-choom changed to a cha-ting, ta-ting, ting, as if the choom-choom weapons were now in high gear. Sticks. Sticks, beating a pattern on the road as the three men increased their pace. I was still in great shape from football, fighting Wharton and all those chin-ups, so I ran at full speed until one of my pursuers lost his wind and dropped out. That still left two men in the darkness with sticks, and I had no idea where I was. I heard the pursuers closing on me. I stopped, wheeled around, and faced them. The leader looked like a bully. The other fellow was smaller. I could see that their sticks were sharpened at the ends. Pig sticks, used for jabbing at pigs to encourage them toward the pen. Then I remembered that I was armed as well. Wrapped around each leg of my MP pants, anchoring the fold where they bloused over my boots, was a bicycle chain. The chains were useful for making an MP's pants look snappy, and sometimes for encouraging drunken soldiers toward the base. I reached down and unhooked the chains. I started whirling them over my head. They made a whirr, far more menacing than the choom-choom or even the cha-ting ta-ting-ting. With my help, the Frenchman eventually came around to that same opinion. I concentrated on the smaller fellow first. He'd move, and I'd go at him. Whack! With a bicycle chain. Whack! He started running backwards, and then the larger guy would lunge at me. Whack! Soon the little guy ran out of gas, and it was just me against the real bully. I kept swinging the chains as hard as I could until he gave it up, and the two faded into the darkness. Panting for breath, I found my way back to the base. After the fist fight and the close call with the communists, there was only one event that could put a capstone on my military career. A visit from my mother. Rose Kennedy loved Paris, and she swirled into the city after I'd been there a few weeks, taking a suite at a favorite hotel, the Ritz. I arranged a 3-day furlough and called for her in a rented limousine, glad to see her as always. I entered the suite in the midst of a crisis. Mother couldn't find her jewelry. She'd hidden it someplace, but she'd forgotten where. We spent 2 or 3 hours combing the hotel room for the precious stones. Finally, she found them, pinned to the inside back of her purse, so that she wouldn't lose them. We drove to the Hotel du Golf near Deauville and enjoyed an overnight visit, during which we ran into some good friends. I found myself in the midst of a black tie party for the Grand Ballet du Marquis de Couvat, featuring Maria Tallchief. I think I borrowed a tuxedo from one of the friends. It was a good break from military life. Returning to the army base late on the final night, with my mother along for the ride, I asked the driver to let me off about 100 yards from the entrance. I didn't want my buddies to see me getting out of a limo. I almost made it. I'd walked through the gate and was headed for the barracks when I heard rapid, tiny footsteps and a familiar voice behind me calling, "Teddy dear! Teddy dear! Oh, Teddy dear!" Do I turn around or keep walking? There was only one choice, of course. I turned around. "Teddy dear!" Mother's bell-like voice was loud enough to wake the guards. "Teddy dear, you forgot your dancing shoes!" My dancing shoes? I watched her hurrying toward me, her small hands clutching 2 shiny objects. She spent a minute or two catching her breath. "Here are your dancing shoes." I looked at them. They weren't even my dancing shoes. I thanked Mother as politely as I could, bade her good night, and turned to face what seemed to be every man in the barracks, all of whom were engrossed in the conversation. From that moment on, I was known around the base as Teddy Dear. Every man had the same question for me. Teddy Dear, do you have your dancing shoes? While I was in the army in France, my siblings back home were making important strides in their lives, toward their futures, and toward one another. In October 1951, Jack and Bobby, along with our sister Pat, set off on a tour of several Eastern and Middle Eastern countries, including Vietnam. Jack was planning a challenge to the senior Republican senator from Massachusetts, Henry Cabot Lodge, Jr. He wanted to sharpen his awareness of Soviet colonial pressure in several nations as a centerpiece of his campaign. The 7-week expedition yielded an unexpected bonus. My two brothers, who had spent long stretches of time apart from one another, virtually since childhood, reacquainted themselves with one another as men. Jack was 34 then, Bobby just shy of 26. Left behind during the tour was the beautiful young socialite, equestrienne, and Vogue inquiring photographer, Jacqueline Bouvier, whom Jack met at a Georgetown dinner party in May of that year. The separation hardly interrupted Jack's courtship of Jackie. The two were married on September 12, 1953, in Newport, Rhode Island. Bobby served as best man, and I was an usher. Bobby resigned his job as an attorney in the Justice Department to manage Jack's Senate campaign with organizational brilliance. He helped steer Jack to a narrow victory over Lodge, and afterward, instead of returning to justice, he applied for a position on the senatorial staff of one of our father's Irish Catholic friends, Joseph McCarthy, who'd become chairman of the Senate Government Operations Committee. McCarthy by then had made his name as a rabid anti-communist witch hunter. The Washington Post cartoonist Herblock had coined the phrase McCarthyism 2 years earlier. The peak of the infamous era that bore his name, though, was still a few years in the future. He had, in fact, visited our family at the Kennedy House in Palm Beach and dated Eunice for a while. Bobby went to work on the subcommittee on investigations for McCarthy, who was just then absorbed in rooting out anti-American books in public libraries. My brother joined two other fresh appointees, Chief Counsel Roy Cohn and Cohn's chief consultant, David Schein. Bobby was not yet 28 then, and the extent of McCarthy's vile exploitation of anti-communist hysteria had not yet fully registered with him, or indeed the country. Bobby developed an instant distrust of Cohn and Schein, perceiving their cynicism and willingness to twist the truth to fit their boss's agenda. He didn't like McCarthy's frequent collaborator and ideological soulmate, the FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, either. He distrusted him from the start. Bobby might have been an anti-communist, but he was sickened by the way Hoover and his allies destroyed lives without remorse. Dad had known J. Edgar Hoover in the early days, back when crime fighting was his focus. Dad liked him then, and had a lot of correspondence with him. My own memory is that until the Cold War came to obsess him with rooting out communists in America, Hoover wasn't so bad. In later years, as my own political career took hold, I came to believe that Hoover had to go. He was out of control, a law unto himself. He kept power by threat and terror, and he held his power for too long. I cringe every time I see his name on that building on Pennsylvania Avenue. He did some good things, but warrantless wiretaps and blackmail by the director of the FBI have no place in this country. Bobby resigned his place on McCarthy's staff just months later, when Democratic members walked off the committee in protest of the chairman's unsavory methods. Yet his personal regard for McCarthy remained another matter. Even after the Wisconsin senator had been stripped of his credibility in 1954, and his career and reputation ruined, Bobby showed friendly feelings for him. He was castigated repeatedly for this, but he probably could not have made himself behave otherwise. Loyalty was one of my brother's greatest virtues, and he would not toss over a friend just because he had fallen out of favor with the world. The following year, with McCarthy gone, Bobby rejoined the subcommittee as chief counsel. In 1955, with Arkansas Senator John McClellan at the head of a reorganized committee, Bobby broke into national prominence as a tough investigator of corruption within the Teamsters Union. This image, in time, evolved into a slur that was perhaps the most offensive and least accurate of the many that Bobby absorbed from his adversaries over the years. It was a slur so contrary to his true nature that its use became an ironic family joke. The slur was ruthless. I don't recall making much use of those dancing shoes that my mother handed me, but the remainder of my army time in Europe passed pleasantly enough. Weekdays of drudge work, followed by weekend furloughs. I used one of those weekends to win a one-man Swiss bobsled race. I'd never been on a bobsled before. In the fall of 1952, I rounded up absentee votes for Jack's Senate race among my fellow Massachusetts soldiers. In February 1953, Pat and Jean came over to help me celebrate my 21st birthday. We went skiing in Austria for a week. In May, Eunice married Sergeant Shriver. So Bobby was married. Eunice was married. Jack was headed for a September wedding with Jackie in Newport. Pat would marry Peter Lawford in April 1954, and Jean would be wed to Stephen Edward Smith in May 1956. It seemed incredible to me. I'd always had a curious, half-fanciful way of thinking about my siblings as regarded marriage, and myself as well. I never expected any of us to get married. We would be brothers and sisters, unchanging, forever. Later that spring, the Army transferred me back to Fort Devens, Massachusetts, for my discharge as a private first class. I'd hardly shaken hands with Dad when I found myself on another tour of duty, one that I was pleased to accept. He asked me to travel to Chicago and Tulsa to inspect some of the family's business investments. When I returned from that assignment, I had some surprising news for my father and the family. I was considering a political career of my own. I spent a few weeks volunteering as a basketball coach at the South Bay Union Settlement House in Boston, and then I enrolled in a pair of summer school government courses at Harvard. In the fall of 1953, I returned to Harvard as a full-time student, determined to work hard and put the past behind me. The class I concentrated on the most that semester was Spanish, where I proudly brought my grade up to an A-. From then on through graduation, I pursued a tough curriculum heavily weighted toward government, economics, history, and English. It was John Kenneth Galbraith who elevated my understanding of economics. In just a few years, he would be Jack's ambassador to India. Arthur N. Holcomb, another Harvard giant who had taught Dad and all three of my brothers, made the Constitutional Convention of 1787 come alive before my eyes. Political philosophy was Holcomb's specialty, and I opened myself to his stirring historical and moral insights. I worked at public speaking with a wonderful speaking coach named Oscar Verlaine. Four times each fall and four times each spring, Verlaine sent me and other students into such venues as South Bay Settlement and various local high schools to address civic matters, such as the Red Cross. Perhaps our topics weren't earth-shaking, but we learned how to develop bonds with our audiences via a sense of conviction, brevity, humor, and tailoring our remarks to their specific level of understanding. These engagements also reinforced in me the satisfactions of public service. My residence now was Winthrop House, on the northern bank above the Charles River. Joe Jr. and Jack had lived there, and Jack's room is now reserved for guests at the university. Winthrop was a popular residence for athletes, and incidentally, one of the first houses to open itself to Jewish and Catholic students. I was ineligible for varsity football when I returned to Harvard in 1953, but I played for Winthrop House. I have especially fond memories of a special game we played in that fall of that year. We traveled to New Haven to play the Eli's top residential club, Davenport, the day before the official Harvard-Yale game. We beat the Davenport boys 6-0, thanks partly to the pile-driving play of a certain stranger to my Winthrop teammates. It was Bobby. I'd invited him to come up from New York and watch the game, but Bobby preferred to play. He'd been wearing neckties and white shirts for 10 years, writing for the Boston Post and working for Dad in the Justice Department. Perfect, I thought. Let's see what he has left. I found him a house uniform and a set of pads. He changed into them en route. He played defensive end in that game, and for an old guy, he did pretty well. In fact, He was the star of the game. As he was coming off the field at the end, our elderly housemaster, Ronald M. Ferry, gave him a close look and said, "Bob, aren't you supposed to graduate fairly soon?" In 1954, I finally realized my dream of trotting out onto the field for the Crimson Varsity. It was not an easy path. I started off on the 8th squad at Harvard. That was the lowest, I think. But I hung in there. I knew I wasn't the best athlete on the team, not by a long shot, but I was determined to work hard and stay with it. And sure enough, as the games went on, a lot of the better-ranked players started to drop off the team. They'd get hurt or decide they didn't want to continue, or football conflicted with chemistry lab. I was lucky. Lucky and determined. I gradually rose up the depth chart. In the Bucknell game, the coach finally sent me onto the field. I was so excited to be in the game that I didn't notice when I got a tooth knocked out. I hardly even merited a sentence from the student paper's sports writer, David Halberstam. I had a chance to earn my varsity H in that year's Yale Classic. I needed just 4 minutes of playing time. But on the first play after I entered the game, an Eli ball carrier swept around my end of the line for a 60-yard gain. Out I came, as Dad threw up his hands on the sideline and my brothers watched in disappointment from the stands. I didn't get back in and I didn't win my varsity letter, though we beat Yale and won the Big Three title. Everyone at Harvard was celebrating. Almost everyone. In my final season in the fall of 1955, I not only started, but averaged 56 minutes a game. Those were the days when the entire line still played both defense and offense. The team itself struggled. We had a dismal 2-7 record for the season. But we never lost heart, and we still gave our all. I caught a touchdown pass as we defeated Columbia on October 5th by a score of 21-7. My most exciting personal moment, though, came in the Harvard-Yale game when a pass went skidding off the hands of its intended receiver, and I reached out and grabbed it and hung on to it as I rumbled into the end zone. I won my letter, but we lost the game 21-7. This time, almost everyone at Harvard was down in the dumps, but not everyone. Dad, who'd brought a couple dozen of his friends from New York and Boston by train, charged into the locker room with Jack and Bobby to noisily congratulate me. I knew they should tone it down, but with Dad and my brothers smiling so broadly over my TD catch and the earning of my letter, I can't say that I was sorry for their enthusiasm. I graduated from Harvard in the spring of 1956, satisfied that I had proved myself both academically and on the playing field. My grades were more than respectable, and I even received a letter from the Green Bay Packers wanting to know whether I wanted to try out for the team. I declined Green Bay's kind offer, but all in all, I was feeling pretty good. That August at the Democratic Convention, Jack made a surprising bid for the nomination as vice president under Adlai Stevenson. He'd electrified the delegates on opening night with his narration of a moving film about the history of the party, which garnered him a lot of positive attention. Jack jumped into the open nomination process. As much as Jack wanted it, Dad was not in favor of his move for the vice presidential nomination because he was sure that President Eisenhower would defeat Stevenson and Jack's political career would be over. In my mother's memoir, she writes of Jack being persuaded to run, despite my father's objections, by a Louisiana delegate who pleaded with him to stay in the race after their delegation had stuck their neck out for him. In an amazing twist of history and fate, that Louisiana delegate was my future father-in-law, Edmund Reggie, then a 30-year-old judge who had managed to swing the Louisiana delegation behind my brother when Governor Earl K. Long had gone to the horse races. At the end of the day, Jack didn't win the nomination, but his experience at the convention was a win all the way around. My father was relieved. Jack's eloquence and grace in concession won him enormous political capital, raising his prospects as a serious contender for the presidency in 1960. And though I could not have imagined the significance at the time, our family began a friendship with the Reggies of Louisiana that some 30 years in the future would transform my life. Meanwhile, I was eager to see more of the world after graduating from Harvard. I asked Jack where he thought I should go, and he suggested North Africa. He was interested in the global anti-colonial movements, and he wanted me to look at the African countries just emerging from European rule, Morocco, Tunisia, and Algeria, which was still engaged in a long and bitter war of independence with France. I traveled with Fred Holborn, the distinguished Harvard political scientist who'd been an instructor of mine. My brothers and father also believed in bringing a knowledgeable source along when traveling in unfamiliar countries, especially those of geopolitical importance, a live-in tutor, so to speak. Jack had arranged meetings for us with key people in certain places, and I had made arrangements with the International News Service as a freelance reporter, just as Jack had done a few years earlier. We drove by car across Spain and took a ferry into Morocco, experiencing our first taste of the exotic early on, high up in the steep and jagged Atlas Mountains. There we were to meet with Sidi Mohammed Ibn Yusuf, the populist nationalist sultan whose exile to Madagascar by the French in 1953 had sparked an uprising. The French, realizing their mistake, returned this eminence to the Moroccan throne in 1955. Just weeks before our visit, Mohammed had negotiated Morocco's independence at Paris. Our visit with Mohammed was memorable for a number of reasons. One was that another guest scheduled to arrive at the same time was El Glohi, a powerful Moroccan militant and recent rival of the king's. El Glohi's visit was of interest to my editor because he had tried to kill Mohammed on two or three previous occasions. The editors assured me that this meeting would be somewhat more amiable. In fact, it was to be a reconciliation. El Glohi was heading up the mountains to pay his tribute and swear allegiance to the king. Holborn and I missed this reunion. It was held inside Mohammed's huge tent, with no outsiders allowed. We were, however, invited to the dazzling ceremonial dinner that followed. The festivities consumed most of an afternoon. The king's harem, 70 women strong, was present. There was dancing and the cutting of a calf. Out on a plain visible from the tent, bareback riders raced along on powerful horses, with rifles tucked under their arms. They would grasp the rifles with an opposite hand and, while at full gallop, hurl them 50 or 75 feet into the air. Without looking, they would grab the guns as they descended and fire them into the air. Then they would bounce off and back onto the horses. It was an unbelievable show. That night, Fred and I were shown to our sleeping area, a corner of the tent about 5 feet from these horses. This experience paled, however, beside our next destination, Algeria, where we traveled around with the Algerian army. We witnessed a prologue to the Battle of Algiers. The French, who were winning at this point, had trapped the city's leaders in the sewer system. We watched as an officer opened a manhole cover and lowered a bird cage with a dove inside, a guarantee of safety to anyone down below who saw it. The French thought they were going to prevail, but you could get the sense that it wasn't going to happen. The French would never bring these outraged nationalists to heel. The insurrection was all around. The Algerians had experienced the most brutal kinds of torture from the colonial army, and this enhanced their hatred and bolstered the movement for independence. Nothing could stop it. After Algeria, I made a rendezvous with Jack as we'd planned. He joined me for a sail in the Mediterranean after the Chicago Convention. I gave him a detailed report of what I had witnessed during my 6 weeks of travel. Jack was keenly interested, but our hiatus was cut short by an urgent message from America. The pregnant Jackie, who had suffered a miscarriage the previous year, had just suffered the second of her three such losses. My brother hurried home to be with his wife. Yet he did not forget our conversation. In a speech a little more than a year later, the new senator, John F. Kennedy, tacitly drew upon the views I'd shared with him to carefully advocate for a tolerable peace in the Algerian conflict, arguing that the dangers of communism only become greater as settlement is postponed. This was essentially the same view my brother held regarding the still young Vietnam conflict at the time of his assassination in 1963. With Jack in the Senate to inspire me, public service was all but inevitable now as my career of choice, and the law was its foundation stone. I was interested in the law school at Stanford University in California. My grades didn't quite qualify me for Harvard Law, but ultimately I decided to follow Bobby's path to the University of Virginia Law School at Charlottesville. These were a rousing 3 years, filled with fun and learning and new friendships. My roommate was John Varick Tunney, the son of the former heavyweight boxing champion Gene Tunney. When I met Gene, I found him to be similar to Dad in his no-nonsense, rough-and-ready approach to life. John was destined to become a Democratic congressman and then senator from California, and among the very closest of my lifelong friends. John is the godfather to Teddy Jr., and I am godfather to John's son, Teddy. We lived in a converted stable a short distance from the campus, where we staged a couple of memorable parties and had a lot of fun. The open, empty country roads were a great escape for me, a place to feel the fresh air on my face and contemplate the good things in life. Unfortunately, from time to time I lost track of the speedometer on my drives, but there always seemed to be a state trooper around to remind me. Still, life was great. I had good friends, and for a while at least, I stopped worrying about catching up and savored the moment. It was Tunney who taught me mountain climbing. More or less. Exposed me to mountain climbing is probably more accurate. He and I and another law student and good friend of ours, named John Gomans, spent 4 weeks at the International Law School at The Hague, studying contract law with the great Hardy Dillard. This put us within range of the famous mountains among the Pennine Alps of Switzerland, the Mischabel group that includes the Matterhorn and the Rimfeschorn. Tunney, who'd climbed while at Yale, decided to let me cut my teeth on an easy one, the Rimfeschorn, which is only 4,000 meters high and comes to an absolute point at the top. We went up with two brothers from the Swiss ski team, Auguste and Heinz Uhlen. It was probably the most terrifying experience of my life. All of us were tied together, with me in between Auguste Uhlen and Tunney. I managed all right until we got close to the top, maybe 20 feet. I saw Auguste put his foot on a little ledge and another foot someplace near that and grab a handhold somewhere else and boost himself up to a larger ledge. He looked down at me and said, "Now it's your turn." After all the climbing we'd done to get to that point, my legs and arms felt like leaden weights. But I had no choice but to keep going. I was almost there. I put my foot where Auguste's had been and my hand where I thought his had been, and I moved my other leg toward the other foothold, which wasn't there. I had just time enough to yell, "Tension! Tension!" which you yell if you're about to fall, and then boom! Down I went. I fell about 20 feet. The rope that encircled my waist slipped up underneath my arms, and I was swinging out there in space about 3,000 feet above the valley. I resisted the temptation to raise my arms and grab the rope. If I raised them, I would slip through the loop and go spiraling through space. And if Auguste couldn't hold the rope, it would be lights out for all of us. Auguste wrapped the rope around a boulder to keep it from slipping away, and then slowly lowered me, letting out more and more slack. But I was beneath an overhang, and I could not touch the mountainside. I looked around and saw Tunney, just about at my level. He reached out and pulled me toward the mountain. He got me back to a very small ledge that could barely fit both of us, but it did. I was absolutely exhausted. The wind was fierce. I called out, "I don't think I can go up any farther. I really don't think I can make it. I'm too tired." "Boys, you've got to climb," Auguste called back. "You've got to get up to the top of the mountain." "Or perish," was the unspoken implication. I owe my life to Tunney. He looked around and spotted another route, a couloir, a corridor formed by large rocks. John managed to wedge himself in between the rocks and move his shoulders upward while keeping his knees braced against the sides. In this way, he managed the 15 or 20 feet to where Auguste waited. I studied his movements carefully and then emulated them, which is why I am not hanging out there to this day. On the far side of the peak was a funicular. We took it back down, and I found myself wondering why we hadn't taken it up as well. I made my mind up that was one sport I would never, ever get into. The next day, we climbed the Matterhorn. Back at the University of Virginia, in the classroom, I threw myself into the study of law as never before. In this pursuit, as in our travel and good times, John and I sparked one another. We teamed up for the classic law school exercise known as moot court. The competition in this extracurricular drill consisted of 75 teams, with debates structured as tennis tournament eliminations. The process spanned nearly the whole of my 3 years at UVA. Free speech was the issue at hand, and John and I took the more liberal position. We had to write briefs that were the product of enormous research. To prepare for our oral arguments, we practiced against a team that we would not meet in the pairings, but which held the opposing view. By the time we reached the semifinals, the quality of competition had skyrocketed. The finals were in May 1959, and Bobby, who'd been through early rounds of the competition when he was in law school, and my sister Pat came down from New York to watch. We had worked hard to get to this point in the competition, and every nerve was on end. The pressure was only heightened by the caliber of our judges. Retired Supreme Court Justice and former Solicitor General of the United States, Stanley Reed, the former Solicitor General and Attorney General who had famously cross-examined Hermann Göring at the Nuremberg trials, the Lord Chancellor of the United Kingdom, David Maxwell Fyfe, the Earl of Kilmure, and U.S. Court of Appeals Judge for the Fourth Circuit, Clement Haynsworth. 10 years into the future as a senator, I would vote against Judge Haynsworth's nomination by Richard Nixon to the Supreme Court. Our opposing team was led by Wayne Lustig, a silver-tongued Southerner who made what even John and I voted as an A-plus argument. Yes, the pressure was definitely on. In the most exciting and rewarding moment of my life to that time, and among those of all time, John and I were declared the winners of the moot court competition. We were overjoyed. Another great tradition at Virginia Law School was the Student Legal Forum, and I was in charge of getting distinguished legal and political figures to come and speak to the students. I was successful at getting some real stars to visit the forum because I had an ally in Jack. He helped us get Hubert Humphrey, who came down and was captivating. 1,000 students showed up to hear him, which pleased Jack enormously when he heard it. We brought in Edward Bennett Williams, who was just then defending Jimmy Hoffa in court. We tried to sandbag Williams on whether Hoffa even had a tenable defense, but he blew us out of the water in about 30 seconds. We had the great union leader Walter Reuther, who was dynamic and spellbinding. We had Victor Riesel, the hard-nosed anti-racketeering labor columnist, who just a few months earlier had been blinded by sulfuric acid thrown into his eyes by an assailant on a Manhattan sidewalk. Supreme Court Justice William Brennan was another of our incredible speakers. I still wince a little when I recall the time we invited Prescott Bush, George Bush's father and George W.'s grandfather, a distinguished senator from Connecticut, and an enormously gracious, dignified person. But not exactly a big marquee name at the University of Virginia Law School. As the date of his appearance drew near, we saw the reverse of what usually happened with ticket requests. Instead of increasing, the demand grew less and less. We'd drawn 1,000 spectators for Humphrey and 800 for Williams. But with Prescott Bush, as the reality of the numbers started to sink in, we realized we'd need only about 400 or 500 seats. Then we thought we'd better get down to 200. We ended up listening to Prescott Bush in a small room with 75 chairs. But he was incredibly pleasant. We had dinner afterward, and like most speakers, he was much more interesting at the dinner. Several weeks later, as I was driving Jack to some appointment or other in Boston, my brother reached over and honked the horn. He pointed to another car. "I know who that is," Jack exclaimed. "That's Press Bush." In the passenger seat was his son, George Herbert Walker Bush. Both cars stopped, and we all got out and yacked it up. The Bushes were headed up to Maine. George Bush mentioned to me that his father had told him about his visit to Virginia Law School and the nice young Kennedy boy. I had privately disagreed with some of Prescott Bush's views, but I had a cordial personal relationship with him, just as I would have with the next two generations of Bushes. After the family's traditional Thanksgiving dinner in Hyannisport in November 1956, Jack and Joe Jr. left the table and repaired to the study near the living room for a private talk. When they emerged, grinning, arms around each other's shoulders, the rest of us learned that Jack had decided to run for president in 1960. Their talk apparently had been a kind of moot court in reverse. Jack citing all the reasons why he should not run. He was Catholic, only 39, none of the party's leaders had indicated any support for such a move, and our father countering each one. Jack would not announce his decision until early in the election year, but a charge of energy ran through our family at once. Getting Jack re-elected to the Senate and then helping him become president, this had become our mission. In October 1957, I got aced out, courtesy of Jack, of a chance to see a professional football game, and as a result, ended up meeting my future wife. The occasion was a Sunday afternoon talk that Jack suggested I give at the dedication ceremony for the Kennedy Physical Education Building at Manhattanville College of the Sacred Heart. Our family had donated the building in memory of Kathleen. My mother, Eunice, and Jean had all attended Manhattanville College, as had the former Ethel Skakel. I had spent Saturday night in Dad's New York apartment with Jack. Giving a talk at a women's college was the last thing on my mind. The Washington Redskins were in town to play the 3-1 Giants, and Dad and I had planned to go see the game on Sunday. It was Jack, not me, who'd originally agreed to give the talk. But when my brother showed up at the apartment and saw me there, he said, "Oh, Dad, since Teddy's here, why don't we let him do it? I want to go to the football game." I didn't think that was a terribly good idea. I'd look forward to seeing that game. Jack held his ground. It was going to be a great game, and he wanted to see it. Our father said, "Fine. Why don't you two work it out?" We worked it out, and Jack went to the football game. I went to the college with my sister Jean. I gave the speech. It was successful enough, I suppose. After my remarks that Sunday afternoon, Margot Murray, a friend of Jean's, took me by the hand and introduced me to an exquisitely beautiful young student named Joan Bennett, who had just turned 21. Jean was with Margot for the introduction, but she had not met Joan before either. I learned later that Joan had done some modeling and was a gifted piano player, which earned her a lot of points with Mother. I definitely wanted to see more of Joan. I thought fast, and talked Margot and Joan into driving me to the airport for my flight back to Virginia. Joan and I headed off in the car. I took her out every time I came up to New York, and almost before we knew it, we were on a fast track toward marriage. The family was thrilled. She was beautiful, she was fun, and she played piano duets with Mother. It was time for me to think about settling down and getting married, and Joan seemed like a perfect match. As for that football game, Jack had the great pleasure of watching the Giants get buried by the Redskins, 31-14. Part 2. Brotherhood. Chapter 6. Kennedy for President, 1958-1960. Jack's re-election to the Senate in 1958 was never in serious question. He was skyrocketing now as a public figure. The camera emphasized his youth, his elegance, his good looks, his quick wit. But while his re-election to the Senate was not in doubt, the margin of victory was very important. Jack's presidential ambitions in 1960 were now a given, at least within the family and closest advisors. That required that every public step along the way be marked with as much evidence of achievement as possible. A great deal of Jack's charm, of course, was substantive, a factor of his unconcealed principles. His political candor was as fresh and bold as his style, and like his style, it won over audiences who might have resented it in any other candidate. He'd drawn a standing ovation in Jackson, Mississippi, after a talk in which he endorsed school desegregation. He won the support of the governor of Kansas, even though he had earlier voted against high farm price supports. He accepted speaking dates before Southern Protestant ministers and the American Jewish Congress in New York. Bobby had managed Jack's first Senate campaign, but now he was absorbed as chief counsel for the Senate Labor Rackets Committee under Chairman John L. McClellan. His lacerating exchanges with the powerful Teamsters boss Jimmy Hoffa were earning him national attention. So Jack asked me to run his campaign. I relished the opportunity. I was still a year from law school graduation and was courting Joan, but the chance to help my brother while at the same time getting a baptism in electoral politics was irresistible. So after my final examinations in June, I hurried home to Massachusetts and joined the senator's re-election team. Jack named me campaign manager, though I was glad to have such able hands as Larry O'Brien, Kenny O'Donnell, and Jean's husband, Steve Smith, to show me the ropes. Here were three immensely talented and loyal political professionals at the core of a group whose names would forever be associated with that of President John F. Kennedy. A mixture of amateurs, professionals, eggheads, and hardheads, the New York Times admiringly called them. Larry O'Brien was an Army veteran, a former Union president at age 22, and a Democratic operative when he came aboard my brother's 1950 Senate campaign. Like Bobby, Larry was passionate about organization. The slightly younger Kenny O'Donnell was also an Army vet who was Bobby's roommate at Harvard after the war. A principled and politically sensitive man, he, along with Larry, remained at Jack's side through the presidential years as a special assistant and member. Steve Smith was more than a brother-in-law. He was like a brother in our family. A soft-spoken and elegant man, Steve had been an Air Force lieutenant before joining his father's vast New York tugboat and barge empire, Cleary Brothers Incorporated. An eventual heir to the fortune, he developed a genius for financial management, eventually overseeing the Kennedy family's investment operations, as well as for personnel supervision. Steve would go on to manage Bobby's Senate campaign and my own. A fourth member of the team was Ted Sorensen, who was virtually inseparable from Jack. The two of them toured 50 states together between 1956 and 1959. Ted had signed on to be the new Senator Kennedy's legislative aide in 1953 as an earnest, horn-rimmed 25-year-old just a couple of years out of Nebraska. And there was Pierre Salinger. Jack had recently hired the dapper 33-year-old journalist and veteran press officer on Bobby's recommendation. Pierre had impressed Bobby as an investigator for the Senate Labor Rackets Committee. He would serve as press secretary to Jack. I took Joan to the house at Hyannisport for a week in June to get her acquainted with my mother and father, and then we all set to work getting Jack reelected. We held our first strategy meeting at the Copley Plaza Hotel in Boston. All the volunteers assembled in a meeting room upstairs, and Jack looked at me and said, "All right, Teddy. Now you go on up and give them a speech. Talk about the organization and what you're going to do in the campaign, and then I'll say a few words." I'd never given a campaign strategy talk before. I said, "What exactly do you think I ought to say?" Jack ticked off several details about how he thought the organization should go and then sent me up. I guess I did okay. Then Jack spoke, and as usual, charmed and inspired everyone. Our biggest challenge was overcoming the apathy of people who thought Jack was a shoo-in for re-election. He probably was, but as I say, the margin was what counted. And so we focused on generating turnout. We set up telephone banks and sent volunteers out for door-to-door efforts. I shuttled weekly between Massachusetts and my law classes at the University of Virginia. We stumbled upon some unexpected controversies. One of them reflected the ancient tensions between the Irish and the Italians in Massachusetts, still intense in the late 1950s. We'd come up with a campaign slogan for Jack, simple yet geared to our goal of a large turnout. It was, "Make your vote count. Vote Kennedy." We discovered that it wasn't so simple, certainly not in the Italian community. A group of Italian-American leaders from around the state converged on Boston and demanded a meeting with me at my brother's headquarters at the Bellevue. They sat down at a conference table opposite me and said, "This is an insult to Italians." I told them I didn't understand. "What we're trying to do is say, make your vote count. Your vote counts for Senator Kennedy in 1958, and it's also a vote, really, for 1960. Your vote is important. Make your vote count." They said, "No, no. The way we interpret it is that the vote counts if it's for an Irishman, but it doesn't count if it's for an Italian." The Italian they had in mind was Vincent J. Celeste. "So therefore it's directed at us, and we resent it." Pretty soon the head of every Italian-American organization in the state was denouncing the slogan. We had to tear up all the literature and change it. I mentioned the crisis to Jack, who was as baffled as I. "I don't know. We'll work it out." We worked it out by calling Dad up from the Cape. We all sat down with one of his friends, an advertising man named John Dowd. Dowd worked at it all day long, trying out slogan after slogan. He was wearing a pinstripe suit, as I recall, with white checks on it, and he had suspenders and a mustache that moved when he talked, and dark, very groomed hair. He had 5 different pencils and pads of paper. He'd write out a slogan and hand it to Dad, and Dad would look at it and say, "No, that doesn't work, Dad. That's not good. You can do better than that. That's not good." And then Dad went across the street to Bailey's restaurant and had his lunch, a chocolate soda. That's all he'd eat. He loved ice cream, but he didn't want to gain weight, so he just had this one chocolate soda. He came back in half an hour. "How are you doing now, Dad?" Dad wasn't doing so well. By this time, he was perspiring, and the dye in his hair was starting to run. After several more hours of frantic scrawling, he handed Dad yet another slip of paper with yet another slogan. "He has served Massachusetts with distinction." I thought that one, frankly, to be a little like a Shenley's whiskey ad, but my father liked it. So that became the slogan. Kennedy. He has served Massachusetts with distinction. One person not ready to agree that Jack had served Massachusetts with distinction was Vincent Celeste. Celeste may have understood that he had little hope of winning, but he and his people were not about to go down without a fight. I recall the night that he took the fight, almost literally, to Jack's window. Jack had rented an apartment at 122 Bowdoin Street in Boston. This was the subject of much amusement in the family, because so many Kennedys were registered to vote with that as their address. It was a small apartment, but Jack and Jackie, Bobby and Ethel, and I were all registered out of this small apartment. Jack loved to take his bath at 122 Bowdoin to soak his back and refresh himself before evening campaign events. This was the time he valued the most in his day, in certain ways. He was then at his most relaxed and funniest, and he came away with a sense of purpose and seriousness. I always sat in the bathroom with him as he called out instructions and asked questions. Just outside the apartment was a fairly large parking lot. One evening, while Jack was in the tub, I heard noises down there. Went to the living room and looked out the window. I saw 8 or 10 people lighting a bonfire in the parking lot, a sizable bonfire.